Okay, thanks. So they're all Y talks. So many of you have known about the YMBCA, or the Young Men's, no, YMBA, the Young Men's Buddhist Association. It's the Y, Me Buddhist Association here on these talks. So we're talking about the question why. This evening I'm answering the question why in a general sense, especially talking about the Four Noble Truths. If I told you all the answers to the question why tonight, you wouldn't need to come here again. So I'm only focusing on some parts of why. And especially that part of why which even concerned the Buddha, which concerns every human being. We're not really so concerned about where we've come from or what we're going to go to. More that we're concerned about the role of happiness in our lives and to alleviate suffering in our lives. Most people, when they come to talk to me, they don't come to talk to me about Buddhism. They come to talk to me about the problems they're having with their husbands, the difficulty with their wives, the problems with their children. And I think it's really unfair to ask a monk those questions. I became a monk to get away from all of that, and now you bring it all to me. But even so, that a monk becomes an expert on these things, and you actually get asked to solve all these problems of married life. Fascinating, isn't it, why you ask problems of a monk who's never been married? Even a couple of weeks ago, I was in Australia. I was invited on a radio program, and that radio program on a popular evening show was a talkback radio program. I should have been a bit more diligent to find out exactly what type of program it was. When I went in the studio, I was introduced to the other person on the show, who was a very well-known, well-qualified sexologist. So it was me and a sexologist on this radio show. And because they had such a hard time pronouncing my name, Ajahn Brahma Wangsa was hard enough. When I tried Ajahn Brahm, they couldn't even handle that. So eventually I became Mr. Monk. But interestingly, even though it was on problems of relationships, when people started phoning in their questions, they always wanted to ask the monk. They say, can I have this question of Mr. Monk? It was fascinating that even though you never studied at a university, you haven't got a degree, you're not a doctor of sexology. Even so, the monk's opinions were sought more than the so-called professional. The only thing which... So I did most of the talking on that show. The only problem was at the end of the show, the sexologist was given a fat check. That was her fee. All I got was a bar of chocolate. But I thought again afterwards, you can't eat checks, but you can eat chocolate. So I think I did rather well. But the point of the matter is, why is it that they do ask monks those sorts of questions? It is because of the nature of a monk's life, the fact that they do, through their meditation, investigate the nature of their mind and investigate the nature of the relationship they have with the world, that the monks understand and gain a great insight into the workings of life. And that deep insight which you get from meditation for your life as a monk is so valuable. It's not only sought for teaching meditation retreats, it's also taught on such talkback radio stations. For example, one question which I was asked, not on this program, but on another program some years earlier in Singapore, where I also was appearing on this late night radio talkback show. I think it was a taxi driver in Singapore, but I could be wrong. But anyway, somebody rang up to ask me this question. They wanted to talk to the monk. They said, I'm having an affair with another woman. My wife doesn't know about it. Is this wrong? Now, what would you say? You'd probably start saying about precepts, and that wouldn't cut much ice with these people. So because I know the nature of the mind, my response was, sir, if you thought it was right, you wouldn't be ringing me up in the first place. Now, you see that a monk can actually cut to the core of things. If you thought it was right, you wouldn't be asking me in the first place. Because I know the psychology of the mind. We know what's right and what's wrong. But sometimes when we know it's wrong, when we feel guilty, we try and ask someone else in the hope that they will say, it's okay, it's right. He wanted that relationship, he knew it was wrong, he wanted someone else to justify it for him. So that's why I told him, if you thought it was right, you wouldn't be ringing me up in the first place. All you want is me to say it's right, don't you? Now you see the psychology which a person can understand when they investigate their own mind. And that is the psychology of clearing away the problems of life and understanding the happiness of life and understanding the way to that happiness. Because of all problems in life, that's the one which people always want to find the solution to. Even many years ago when I was a young monk, I decided that all the teachings of life could all be summed up in two questions. Number one, what is real happiness? And number two, how do you attain real happiness? If you can only answer those two questions, what actually is happiness? And how do we reach that true happiness? Then really you have all the philosophy, all the religion you ever need in this life or any life. And sometimes when people ask me, what is the meaning of life? That is the meaning of life. To discover real happiness. Because this is what we all are inclining towards. No matter what we do in life, we work, we go to work. Why? For the sake of trying to find happiness. We get married to try and find real happiness. And sometimes we get divorced to try and find real happiness. We have children, we come to temples to try and find happiness. One of those stories which I told, I think I told this last time at the Global Conference. It's a fascinating story about the search for happiness, because this was one of the reasons why I became a monk. One of the reasons why I became a monk was actually for the search of happiness, because I was always questioning. It's interesting to know that all religious leaders were rebels. The Buddha was a rebel. He went against the traditional ways of doing things at that time and that place. At first he was not accepted. At first he was even criticized by his own family for taking away husbands and fathers into the Sangha. He was criticized as the son of a wealthy man for begging in the streets in the morning. He was criticized by the other people of that time for teaching such things as non-self. All religious teachers are rebels. And as we get the religion, whether it's Christianity, Islam, or Buddhism, after a while, those rebellious teachings, they get massaged into being acceptable to the many, and the religion becomes a tradition whose meaning is never really understood, and that religion dies. But every now and again in those religions, as other people come up, the great monks, the great nuns of those traditions, who tend to revitalize the dull and decaying tradition. Even my teacher, Ajahn Chah, he was a rebel. He was doing things which no other monk in that area was doing, like not accepting money, like eating one meal a day, like going back to the original traditions, like meditating. And I remember once being in his monastery when a delegation of senior monks came from Bangkok to check him out, to make sure that he wasn't breaking the Sangha, creating a schism, because he was rebellious. He was doing things which no other person was doing. But he revitalized that part of the Sangha. Always, whether it's any organization or institution, after a while it becomes slack, lazy, fat. And you do need to be stirred up every now and again. That is a job of religion, to rebel. And that's a job of any seeker, anyone who wants to know the truth. You can know the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. One of the most interesting of stories was when he put his bowl in the river Niranjara, made a determination, if I am to become enlightened, may my bowl float upstream against the current. And it did float against the current. In the stories that was taken as an auspicious sign that he was about to become a Buddha. But it means much more than that. It not only was a sign, but it was an indication of what he needed to do to become enlightened, to go against the stream of the world. And this is what we need to do to find happiness, to go against the stream of the world. Because as a student, I started looking into what happiness really meant. Please excuse me if you've heard the story before. It's important. Somebody's getting involved. I think it must be, in Buddhism we have this idea of Mara. Whenever you're teaching deep teachings, this Mara, this devilish being, sometimes gets into the PA systems and messes it around. Because he's scared that people might hear the true Dhamma and become enlightened. And so I think Mara has got into the microphone. But anyhow, going back to this story, when I was young in England going to school, I was doing my O-level examinations. This was one of the important examinations. At that time, I liked playing soccer in the local park with my friends. My parents and my teachers told me, don't go playing soccer in the evenings with your friends. Stay home, do your homework, study hard, because when you pass your O-levels, that's an important exam, then you'll be happy. It's important. So I gave up playing soccer. I stayed at home. I studied, did my homework, and I did very well in my O-level examinations. But it was quite surprising. After passing those exams, I wasn't happy because I had to do more exams. I had to do A-levels. When I was doing the A-level examinations, I wasn't chasing footballs anymore. I was chasing girls. And so my parents and teachers said, don't go to the parties or the dances. Don't waste your time. Stay at home, read your books, do your homework, study. Because if you pass your A-levels, then you'll really be happy. Once again, I believed them. I stayed at home, did my homework, studied hard, and I did very well at my A-levels. But was I happy? No. You had to go to university to do more exams. And sometimes you started to wonder when you're at university, when is this happiness which people promise ever going to happen? As I tell people usually in this story, when I was at university, I started to become suspicious. Because I saw many other people who'd finished their degrees at university. When they finished their degrees, were they happy? You have to go to work. And if you think university is hard work, you have to work for somebody else in a job that really is hard work. So all the people who had actually finished their degrees, they still weren't happy. Some of them were actually going out with their girlfriends, their boyfriends. They were thinking that once I find my partner in life, once I get married, then I'll be happy. But when a person gets married, are they happy? You all know the story of the three rings of marriage. Remember the three rings of marriage? The first ring of marriage is the engagement ring. The second ring of marriage is the wedding ring. And the third ring of marriage is suffering. So even when you're married, you're still not happy yet. Because when you get married, you have to find an apartment or a house. It's more expensive living with another person than living by yourself. So you try and work hard to get a nice house to set yourself up in life. It's really hard work. Because you think, I'll work extra hours because when we get our house together, then we'll be happy. In the meantime, you usually have children. Once you have children, you put your happiness back for many, many more years. And many people, which I saw at the time, they had their children. They were all thinking that when my children leave home, then I'll be happy. They're always putting their happiness off into some time in the future. And when their children did leave home, that was usually the time when they were close to retirement. And all the old people I knew, they were all saying, when I retire, then I can do what I want, then I'll be happy. And those people who had retired, those are the ones I saw going to churches in England. And the reason they go to churches, how many people go to churches or temples when they're old? Why do they do that? Because they think if they go to a church and temple, that when they die, then they'll be happy. For many people, happiness is always in the future. Some elusive dream which they could never really get to. Some pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. For many people, happiness is when your soccer team wins the Champions League. It's when you win the lottery. When you go on holiday, the dream trip of a lifetime. And many yogis in this retreat, they think, when I get jhana, then I'll be happy. Or when I get enlightened, then I'll be happy. The happiness is always somewhere in the future. And that I rebelled against, that the Buddha rebelled against. Because his first teaching was the Four Noble Truths. The why of happiness, the why of suffering. It is an important thing to understand what the Buddha taught. I mentioned this in brief this afternoon to the yogis on the retreat. Because whether you're practicing on a retreat, whether you're living in life, whether you're a mother, a father, a worker, or whatever, those Four Noble Truths give you the answers to the question why. The Four Noble Truths, as I rearrange them, are not the usual way of suffering, its cause, the end of suffering, and the path leading to the end of suffering. Those of you who have heard Buddhism before, remember I'm rebelling. I turn it around. The third noble truth becomes the first. And the first becomes the third. Because I teach the Four Noble Truths, as explained by the Buddha, as number one, the noble truth of happiness. Number two, the noble truth of the cause of happiness. Number three, the noble truth of unhappiness. And number four, the noble truth of the cause of unhappiness. And you know the reason why I do this? Marketing. Because you start to teach people suffering and they think, I get enough of that at home with my husband. I don't want to learn more about that. How many people want to know suffering? But how many people want to know happiness? Because what I'm doing, I'm just switching them around. The third noble truth, the end of suffering, is happiness. That's what happiness means, the end of suffering. Nibbana, the ultimate happiness, said the Buddha. So I put happiness first, and then the cause of happiness. Do you want to be happy? How come you're not always happy? I'm going to tell you why this evening. Why happiness comes. That's called the cause of happiness. The third noble truth is unhappiness. Why unhappiness? Why doesn't it work out? This evening I'm going to tell you the cause. So these are the four noble truths. Put in a way which is closer to people's hearts. Ways they really want to find out about their life. So we have, first of all, unhappiness. Why is there unhappiness in life? And the answer is craving. Wanting something you can never get. Many years ago, a soldier came to see my teacher Ajahn Chah in his monastery in Thailand. He'd been drafted into the Thai army. He'd been sent to a border region where in a skirmish, I think with the Khmer Rouge at that time. With a skirmish, he'd been wounded and had spent many days in pain in hospital. And he asked Ajahn Chah, why am I so unlucky? Why have I got such bad luck? Why did this happen to me? Why did I get shot? And Ajahn Chah looked at him and said, "What is your job?" He says, "I'm a soldier." Ajahn Chah said, "What do you expect?" That's what happens to soldiers. They get shot at. It's par for the course. It's to be expected. You can anticipate that if you're a soldier, the chances are you're going to get shot at one day. And of all those soldiers, some are going to get wounded. That's understandable, isn't it? So he understood that the cause of his unhappiness was joining the army. He went away satisfied. The interesting part of this story was the next person who came to see Ajahn Chah was a woman who came to complain about her husband. And Ajahn Chah said, "Are you married to a man?" He said, "Yes, he's my husband." Ajahn Chah said, "Well, what do you expect having a husband? That's what husbands are like." If you have a husband, this is what happens to many people. Just like if you're a soldier, that's what that happens, you're liable to get shot at. What do you expect? Now you can see that why is it we always complain? Whether it's your husband or your wife, you think, "Why me, why me, why me?" The answer is that this is what happens when you get married. Many of you come to the monks and complain, "Oh, my son, he's not behaving himself, he's not doing what I want. My daughter is not being obedient and being respectful." And you know what I answer? That's the way daughters are, that's what sons are. What do you expect? If you didn't want that, you shouldn't have had a daughter or a son in the first place. And anyway, look, there's too many sons and daughters in the world. There's too many people. Even here in Penang, you know how much the house prices are going up because of overpopulation? Overpopulation is one of the biggest problems in our modern world. And at least I am doing my part to solve that problem. And so is a venerable monk next to me. So we're environmentally sound monks because we don't have kids. So we look at the cause of our suffering. A lot of it is misunderstanding. We think that life can give us something which it never can. We crave for things which can never be given. So a lot of suffering, the cause of suffering is twofold. It's craving based on delusion. Thinking we can get something which we can never attain. So first of all, we should know the rules of life. What's possible in life? If you get married, that's what happens. You know the Latin word, marriage, it comes from the word to gamble. It's the same root as to gamble. Because if you get married, you don't know what you're going to marry until 1 or 2 years after living with them. So it's a big gamble, no matter what you think, or no matter what your parents think. It is a big gamble. The same when you have children. They have your genes, but they have karma from a previous life. They come into your life, who knows from where. And all you do is look after them. They're not the same as you. Even if you look after them, you train them, you care for them. I know many parents who are very good, very caring parents. They don't indulge their child, they discipline their child, but fairly and kindly, they look after their child, but still their child turns out to be something which is very hard to bear. Sometimes they get into criminal activity, sometimes they go out with the wrong people. Even though the parents are faultless, sometimes the child is no good. And the opposite thing happens as well. Even though the parents do not look after their kids at all, do not send them to nice schools, do not teach them, discipline them or anything, but still they turn out to be wonderful children. What we're saying there is, what the parents do is only a part of what makes that child into a good child. It's also their karma from the past is important. So when you have a child, it's not up to you completely whether that child turns out to be a good child or a bad child. It's their karma as well. So when you have a child, at least you know that you give it the very best, but if it turns out wrong, it's not your fault. You don't need to suffer because you understand the rules, the laws of the game, as it were. You've done your best, now you have to let go. It's the same with your life. Sometimes you try your very best to do well at work, to get on in life, to be reasonably wealthy. But what is it? Sometimes some people in their job, in their business, they work so hard, and they work even harder than others, but still they don't succeed like the person next door. It's a lot to do with your karma. When you understand the laws of the game, the law of karma, you realize you give your very best, and that's all you can do. No more than that. So you don't always expect what the world cannot offer you. Sometimes people ask me in Perth, "Ajahn Brahm, I know you've got good meditation. Ajahn Brahm, you can probably see the next lottery numbers which are coming up. Ajahn Brahm, please let me have the lottery numbers." You know what I answered to them? I said, "Look, if I give it to you, I should give it to all of my disciples, which are very many." They said, "No, don't give it to everybody. Then I'd have to share the prize. It won't be worth anything. Just give it to me." Now, of course, you can't do that. Obviously, that in a lottery, the rules of the game are that most people lose. Can't we understand that and realize that we are most people who are liable to lose? When we go gambling, can't we realize that the only people who get rich out of gambling is the bookmakers? So we shouldn't really gamble. Do you remember the story of the five angels? Could you put your hand up if you remember the story of the five angels and the gambling? It's only one or two. Okay. This is a story about suffering and its cause. Because I tell this story because many, especially Chinese people, number one, they like gambling, and number two, they like fortune telling. One day in Australia, a man had a dream. It was a very clear dream. He dreamt of five angels. And those five angels each came up to him and gave him five pots of gold each. 25 pots full of gold. It's worth a fortune. Many millions of dollars. When he received the last pot of gold, as often happens in dreams, he woke up. When he woke up, he looked around his bedroom and he could see no angels anymore. Even worse, he could see no gold. He realized it was only a dream. But it was a very powerful dream, and he remembered that dream as he walked downstairs to the kitchen for his breakfast. He saw that his wife had made him five pieces of toast and five boiled eggs for his breakfast. He couldn't understand why five, until he looked at the newspaper and noticed the date was the 5th of May, the 5th day of the 5th month. The number five was standing out very prominently to him. He looked in the back of the newspaper, to the sporting section, to the horse racing, and in a race course called Ascot, A-S-C-O-T, five letters. In race number five, horse number five, he could not believe his eyes. Race number five, horse number five, was called Five Angels. This was a sign. You only get these prophecies maybe once in a lifetime. Some heavenly being, some spirit had taken kindness on him and decided to tell him this prophecy. So without telling his wife, he took the afternoon off work. At lunchtime he went to his bank To keep the lucky number 5, he took out $5,000 from his bank account. If you're going to win, you might as well win big. And he went to the race course. To keep the lucky number 5 again, he chose the 5th bookmaker in line. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He went out to him, $5,000 to win. Horse number 5, race number 5, 5 angels. And you know what happened? It came in 5th. which serves him right. Now that's called suffering. And the cause of the suffering was again craving based upon delusion. Whenever we crave for things which the world can't give us, that is when we suffer immensely. Now there's the opposite of that, is the noble truth on happiness and the cause of happiness. That cause of happiness is called the letting go. And this afternoon I mentioned the 4 types of letting go, which I'm going to repeat now, because not only do I want to reinforce this for the meditators on the retreat, but also for those who've just come. This is the Buddha's teaching on the causes of happiness. He said the cause of happiness, the first part of letting go, is giving, expecting nothing back in return. Very often in life, we work expecting something back. Very often in life, we give to our husband or our wife expecting something back in return. Very often in life, we do even charity work expecting recognition, expecting something back in return. That's not giving, that is doing business, that is wanting something. And every time we sort of want something back in return, that will always be the cause of suffering. The selfless giving, the selfless service, the selfless giving yourself to the duties to your parents, to your wife, to your husband, to your children, expecting nothing back in return, that is called freedom from suffering. It is giving, not expecting. It is the beautiful part of compassion and caring, which is a cause of happiness in life. Because whenever we want something back, half the time we will be disappointed. The other cause, although the other type of letting go, these are the only two I'm going to focus on this evening. The other cause, the other type of letting go is called freedom, which is contentment. This was a story, please forgive me for repeating this. I said this afternoon to the yogis here. One of my monks was teaching in a prison. After his lesson, the prisoners offered him a cup of tea. They were becoming friendly with him, and they asked him what it's like in my monastery in Australia. My monastery in Australia is quite strict and disciplined. It's part of the forest tradition. At that time, it was very, very strict. We'd get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. The prisoner said, 3 o'clock in the morning? Is that everyone has to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning? The monk said, no, it's voluntary. You can always get up earlier if you want to. Now, what do you do? To get sort of a cup of coffee or something? No. You have to go and chant and sit until dawn. In dawn, maybe you might get a cup of tea, maybe not. But you have to work very hard for the next 2 or 3 hours. When you get your lunch, it's all eaten in the same bowl. Everything get mixed together. You may have some noodles on top of which goes ice cream. You may have some curry on the top of which goes your sweets. This is what happens in our monastery. The prisoners were aghast. Can't they even afford another plate for your sweets? No. In the afternoon, is there any sport? Do the monks play soccer? No. Is there any sex? No. Any TV? No. Any radio? Any music? Can you play CDs? No. And in the evening, there's no meal. What? You don't have dinner? No. You just have to meditate all night. Until you get tired, then you sleep on the floor. They don't even give you a bed? No. The prisoners were so upset at how monks live in my monastery that one decided they're going to write to Amnesty International. And the other one said, that's terrible. They forgot where they were. That's terrible. They were so upset that their friend, the monk they liked, was living such a terrible, harsh lifestyle. They said, that's awful. Why don't you come in here and live with us? They invited the monk to go to jail. Because jails in Australia are much, much, much more comfortable than the facilities in my monastery. Now the interesting part of this, if that's the case, why don't monks in my monastery try to escape? Actually, I don't know. Maybe when I go back there, they've all gone. Why don't they try to escape? And why in a prison, no matter how comfortable you make it, do the prisoners want to get out as soon as possible? Now the reason is this gives you the idea of the cause of suffering and the end of suffering. In a prison, doesn't matter how comfortable it is, people do not want to be there. That's why it's called a prison. In my monastery, it doesn't matter how harsh it is, people are content to be there. That's why it's freedom. Any place you don't want to be is a prison for you. Now in your life, how many places are there you don't want to be? Sometimes you have a marriage which is not working out. You don't want to be there. Therefore your marriage becomes a prison for you. Sometimes you've got a child who's not behaving. You don't want it to be like that. It becomes a prison for you. Sometimes you have a mental illness like depression. You hate it. Then you're in a prison. Sometimes you have a sick body. You have a sick body. I don't want to be here. Then it becomes a prison for you. Any place you don't want to be is a prison, and a prison is a place of suffering. How can you escape from the prisons of sufferings of life? You don't need to change your partner. Divorces are expensive. Getting married is grand. Getting divorced is $100,000. You don't need to change your job. You don't need to change your body. You don't even need to change your mind if you're depressed. The way out of those prisons, said the Buddha, the way of letting go is to be content to be there. Just like in my monastery, people are happy to be there. That's why they feel free. To be content with the husband you've got. To be content with the wife you've got. One of the reasons why we suffer, the cause of suffering, is because these days we have little gratitude, but we develop the fault-finding mind, always seeing what's wrong with the other person, very rarely seeing what's right. Yesterday in Ipoh, I told the story when I was giving a lecture in one of the universities in KL, maybe 2 years ago. After the talk was finished, one of the people put their hand up. A young woman asked a question. Again, she wanted my advice about marriage. Again, monks giving marriage guidance counseling. You know, I think one of the reasons why people like to ask monks about counseling, about psychology, is because they're cheap. Other places you've got to pay money. For monks it's free. So she put her hand up and she said, a couple of days ago, she said to me, my husband lied to me. I can't trust him anymore. Should I get divorced? Now this is probably may have happened to you and will happen in the future. Your husband or your wife tells you a lie. I can't trust him anymore. Should I get divorced? My answer to her was to first inquire what she was doing at university. She told me she was a lecturer in mathematics. And that gave me the opening to give her an innovative answer, which got to the point. I said, you teach mathematics? Yeah. How long have you been married to your husband? She said, about 3 years. Well, I said, let's do some statistics. 3 years you've been married to her, to him. Let's call that, 365 days a year, let's call that approximately 1,000 days of marriage. Let's assume that every day, on average, he says to you 20 things which could be right or could be wrong. So in your life together, he said 20,000 things in all which could be right or could be wrong. Now he's lied to you for the first time. According to probability theory, the next time he says anything, there's a 20,000 to 1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean he's untrustworthy? Isn't 20,000 to 1 reliable? Of course it is. Now we put it that way and we realize our mistake. Because they've told a lie once, why do we think they will tell a lie again? Why don't we see the truth that 20,000 to 1 is a pretty good track record? The reason is because when people tell a lie, that's all we see. We tend to focus on the faults of what went wrong. It's the same with anyone else who cheats us in life. They may have been our friend for many years, and now they've made one mistake, and we can't stand them any longer, and we break off that friendship. We may make a mistake ourselves in life. One mistake we make, and we feel so guilty for that. All we ever see is our one mistake. You see how we focus on mistakes, on faults, to the exclusion of everything else. This is why we suffer. While we can't stand our husband, our children, we just see the faults which they do. It's why also we get stressed out at work. We always start to think about what needs to be done next. I work hard as a monk. I am a CEO, a chief executive officer of a branch of a multinational company. The multinational company with branches all over the world is called the Sangha. It's the oldest multinational in the world. Started 26,000 years ago with franchises in every country. And my franchise is in Perth. And I'm the CEO. I work very hard. It got to the state where there were so many things I needed to do. Sometimes you always were working so much. I decided a way out, a strategy of learning how to relax. Every Monday morning, for anything, for exercise even, I decided to go on a walk around my monastery. But when I was walking around my monastery, I made a resolution that I would not look at the faults. I would not look at the work which needs to be done. I would not look about anything which was wrong. Instead, I would look for the work which had already been done. I would look at all that's been accomplished. I would look at all that was in the right place. all that was well done. And when I did that, I went round my monastery and I realized how much work had been done well in all those years. How good were the monks. How beautiful was the forest. I had to do that on purpose, because as a manager, as a CEO, as an abbot, don't you always see what needs to be done? The faults, the work in the in-tray, and you never see the work in the out-tray. When you have gratitude, when you look at all that's been done in life, when you look not at the faults but all you've achieved, then you can be at peace. This is how we become free. Not by trying to change what's happened, but learning to be content with it. This even happens in one of the big sources of suffering in a person's life, a death in the family. So often people come up to me and ask the questions about grief. Again, monks are some of the best grief counselors. Again, because we're cheap. Some years ago, again, I was invited to one of the seminars on grief in Australia. I was invited to give one of the keynote addresses of this seminar with all the experts, these professors and these sociologists, on grief. What happens when a person dies? And I was just so moved that after giving my presentation, when it was question time, somebody asked a question of this professor, and she turned to me and said, "Ask him, he is the expert." And it is true that monks are not just cheap, because of our knowledge of the mind. We know all about grief and the way out of grief. The way out of grief is, again, not looking at what's been taken away, but looking at what you've had. When somebody dies, how often do people think, "Oh, the years which have been taken away." When a person is young and dies, they say they were only 16 or 17. Just most of their life has been taken away from them. It's so unfair. When you look at what's been stolen from you, that's when you find grief and unhappiness. But of course, that's not looking at the full picture. Instead of looking at what's been taken away from you, the years in the future when they're not going to be there for you, how about looking at the time we've had together? Looking at what you've had, of what's been completed, of all that's there, rather than all that's been taken away. It's called gratitude. One of the ways of doing this is asking the person who's grieving, "Would you rather have never known that person? Would you rather that child never came into your life? Would you rather have never known your father or your mother and been an orphan instead?" They say, "No, of course not. I love my mother. I love my father. Well, I'm just sad they've been taken away." He said, look at the time you've had together. Be grateful for those moments, for those days, for those years. When you look at what you've had, rather than what's been taken away, you find that most of grief disappears. You're becoming free by being content with what's happened. You can't change a death, but you can be content with it. "I'm happy to be here, so I'm happy to have known that person for so many years." You've heard me say before the story of the concert. I always look upon life like a beautiful concert. When I went to concerts as a young man in England, before I became a monk that was, after the concert was finished, I, like many others, would stand up and shout for more. That's what you do. Sometimes the musicians, the band would carry on, but eventually they had to stop, and I had to go home. Every time the concert ended, I never felt sad. Even though I went outside into a cold, grey, dark, wet London night. London is gloomy at night time. I never cried. I never cried after a concert, even though I knew I'd probably never hear that music again. I never cried because I was inspired. What a marvelous music that was. What a great concert. How lucky I was to have been there. I was grateful for the opportunity of having listened to great music. And that's how I felt when my father died. That's how I feel when any person dies, even a great friend. What marvelous music that is. How lucky I was to have been there and known that person. My father, my mother, my wife, my husband, my friend, even your child, 1 year, 2 years old. What a wonderful time we had together, those 1 year or 2 years. How grateful I was to have known them for that short time. This is realizing what one had, rather than focusing on what's been taken away. All it needs is a change of attitude. Not changing the world, but changing the way you look at it. This is what the Buddha meant by ending craving and learning how to let go and have contentment. You are free when you're content to be there. Realizing this is part of life, this is part of the course. When you do this, you start to understand what the Buddha meant by letting go, by freedom from desire, by freedom from craving, by being at peace with the world. How many of us make war rather than make peace? We make war with our husband by trying to change him. We make war with our wife by turning her off. We make war with our kids by trying to make them into doctors, engineers, which they can never become. We make war with ourselves when we make mistakes. The Buddha never taught to make war. He taught to make peace. We make peace with our life, not by conquering it, by being at peace with it. That's how we end suffering. Just in my room, there was a kid's picture of the Buddha subduing the wild elephant Nalagiri. Many of you know that story. Nalagiri was this mad elephant sent to kill the Buddha. It was intoxicated with alcohol, in rage, and went running towards the Buddha. And what did the Buddha do? Just gave it loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to you. No matter what you do. The Buddha could subdue a raging elephant about to kill him. Surely you can subdue your raging wife. Not with ill will, but with loving kindness. Surely you can subdue your children. Not with ill will, but with kindness. Making peace, not war. We make peace with ourselves. Even I mentioned in passing mental illnesses such as depression, which is increasing in our modern world, even in Malaysia. There was an article in the paper today, someone gave me a newspaper to read on the way up. It was about depression and the Star. Or was it the Sun? I forget which, one of those papers. In depression, what happens when a person is depressed? They say, I don't want to be depressed. When they say, I don't want to be depressed, it's called double depression. They're already depressed, now they become depressed about being depressed. And this is actually what happens to people. They go into this spiral of being depressed about being depressed about being depressed. It gets worse and worse. Imagine saying to depression, depression, the door of my heart's open to you. I'll make my peace with depression. I'll be content to be depressed. I won't try and be anything else. You will find that because of that, there is a sense of freedom. Depression disappears. Even like that story of this monk who got two types of typhus at the same time as a young monk in Thailand. He was a Rhodes Scholar. He had typhus so bad, two strains, he came so close to dying. I talked to a doctor who met him at the station in Bangkok, in an ambulance on the platform, because we told him this monk was very, very sick. And that doctor said to me that he took one look at this Rhodes Scholar monk and said there's no chance to get him to hospital in time. He was in shock, close to death, but they got him to hospital, he survived. But only just. He was very sick for about 3 years. So sick that we took him to our monastery in England, thinking that you get better treatment there. We tried all types of treatment, from Chinese medicine, modern medicine, every medicine you can possibly imagine. Nothing worked. One day, the abbot of the monastery had a great insight into the condition. He went up to that monk and said to him, I've come up here on behalf of all the monks and nuns in this monastery, on behalf of all the aunties and uncles, the laymen, the laywomen who support this monastery, on behalf of all your family, on behalf of everyone who cares for you. I've come up here on behalf of everybody to give you permission to die. It's all right to die. Stop trying so hard to live. And at that, this tough Rhodes Scholar, who used to be a champion wrestler, started crying. He wept and wept. And from that time on, he started to get better. He started to improve, and he's better to this day. He's still alive. That was many years ago. That abbot saw the problem. He was trying so hard to get better, it was making him sick. Now, do you understand about much of sickness, much of depression, much of our problems in life? We try so hard to get rid of them. We make war with them. And that's why they get worse and worse and worse. The Buddha was compassionate. He made peace, not war. That abbot encouraged that monk to make peace with his sickness, not try to get better. He relaxed, he let go, he stopped having stress, and that was enough to give his body a chance to heal. The Buddha said, with the law of suffering, letting go, contentment, peace, ending craving is the way to end suffering. So what are you doing in your life? If your life has more and more suffering in it, what are you doing? Why is that suffering coming up? Are you trying to change things which you can't change? Are you being like that soldier who complains about being wounded? And that's part of life. Are you complaining about your husband, your wife? Are you just focusing on the few faults? Are you really trying to change things like a death which you can't change? Are you appreciating what is good in life, what is good in you, what is good in your children, like I did every Monday morning with my monastery? Are you learning how to be free, or are you placing yourself in one prison after another? What are you doing in your life to end suffering? If you look why, then you'll find the answers. The Buddha gave the answers to the question, why do I suffer? Why do I feel happy? Those are the answers. Investigate, and then you'll find the Buddha's first sermon, the Four Noble Truths, answered the questions of life. There we go. My time is up. Any questions? Who's got a question today? Now, okay, why do I have to keep saying this every time? The Buddha, when he taught about karma and rebirth, he started telling the reasons why. Do you want to know the reason how you can get reborn in rich in your next life? Do you want to be rich in your next life? The Buddha told the reason how to become rich in your next life. He also said why some people are born poor in their next life. He said why some people are born beautiful in the next life while other people are born ugly in the next life. In particular, what I said this afternoon to the yogis here, he said the reason why some people are born stupid in the next life while other people are born intelligent in the next life. The reason the Buddha said why people are born stupid in their next life is because they do not ask questions in this life. So, are there any questions? Any questions anyone would like to ask about the talk tonight? My goodness, Penang is going to be very hard up for professors in the next life. These are the laws of suffering. Have you got a question there? Go on.
Your contentment, sorry?
Aha, your contentment, not making any effort to change. It's really interesting about effort. Now, especially this is for the yogis here, those on retreat. All your effort should go not into changing, but to knowing what you're trying to change in the first place. All the effort should go into mindfulness, not into changing. So you're aware of what's going on, not putting all the attention in trying to get rid of this or trying to get something else. Because what happens when our energy goes into doing things? We miss what's really going on. One of the similes here, which I was probably going to say tomorrow, but I'll probably say it again tomorrow and I'll say it now as well. My monastery in Australia is on top of a hill. The reason why monasteries like mine are on top of a hill because of tradition. Holy men are always supposed to be found on top of mountains. You never see a holy man living in a swamp. So because of tradition, we built our monastery on top of a hill. That monastery is about just over 2 kilometers from the foot of the hill to the top. For many years, for over 10 years, I would go in a vehicle, in a car, up that hill. I would see that hill through the window of that car, and I was so familiar with it that it surprised me one day when I decided for the very first time to walk up that hill. Because when I started walking up that hill, I couldn't believe it. That hill looked completely different. It looked completely different to anything I'd ever seen before. Was that hill I've been up and down for 10 years? It looked so different, so more detailed, so much more beautiful that I stopped. When I stopped and looked again, it changed once more. This time it was even more detailed, more rich, more beautiful, more coloured. I started to see things I'd never seen there before. It was such a strange experience, so unexpected. And I thought and contemplated it. What is going on? I realized that when you're looking through the window of a speeding car, your eyes do not have the time to pick up much detail. And your brain doesn't have time to process it all. All you're seeing is flashes of scenery. When you go slower, when I was walking, my eyes had more time. It saw much more. Much more was registered on the eye. And also my brain had more time to see it more clearly. That's why it became richer in detail and depth. But only when I stopped still could I see it completely. Only then did my eyes have all the time in the world to pick up all the detail of the leaves, the grass, the pieces of rock, the boulders, the trees, and the river running in the valley below. Only then did it start to appear rich and fully detailed when I stopped. And I made the association with life. When we're going fast in life, trying to change the position of where we are, it's like going in a fast car. For most people, life is experienced like I was experiencing that hill, through the window of a speeding mind. All we get is flashes of scenery. We don't see things in detail because we're rushing off to the next thing. That's why life is never fully understood in depth, and also why it doesn't appear so beautiful. When we slow down, we see more deeply. We see more detail because our senses have got more time. Moreover, what was drab and uninspiring starts to become more beautiful, richer in detail. When we stop, it changes again. When our minds stop running onto the next thing or try to get rid of this we're experiencing now, only then do we see it deeply. And then it changes to being quite beautiful. The monastery, with all its austerity, which we want to change, suddenly becomes very beautiful. We actually do find contentment where we are. Where will you find happiness? Is it in the next experience? When you pass your O levels, you pass your A levels, when you get married, when you change your posture, when you get to jhana, when you change your boyfriend, when you change your job? Will you get happiness when you change this body to get another one in your next life? We're going so fast, we never see that happiness is to be found now. Not in anything else but the thing you're experiencing now. You let go and everything stops. When it stops, you see deeply into things. That's called insight. And happiness comes. When you're not running off to the next thing, when you're not trying to get rid of this, that's a meditation teaching. The effort goes into knowing, into stopping, into seeing where one is, not where one is going, nor from where one has come. Like my monastery, when I stopped, I could appreciate it. On a Monday morning, stop trying to think all that needs to be done. Look at what's been appreciated, what has been done already. Then I got gratitude. Stop looking at the faults in your children, seeing at their good qualities, what they've achieved so far, and then you'll have love for your children. Don't look at the faults in your husband. Look at the good things which he's done, the things you can feel proud of. Then you're at peace with him. We focus too much on the faults in life. One time they told a lie. 20,000 times they didn't. Understand? Any other question? Yeah. You're asking about that story about the Buddha putting his bowl in the Nirmanjala River and the bowl going upstream against the current. Could that be tidal? Nirmanjala River, that was by Bodh Gaya, that's a long way from the ocean and the tides don't go up that far. That was a current going down and that was amazing. You're going against the current. And against the current, again, is always wanting to change things. Most wise people have said everybody wants to change the world, nobody wants to change themselves. What does changing themselves mean? It means stopping, seeing what's there. Everybody is moving, very few people are stopping to see where they are. How much in life are we always going on to the next thing, always doing things? In meditation, we stop. One of those stories was of that novice in Ajahn Chah's monastery. Several years ago, when Ajahn Chah was still alive, my teacher. When Ajahn Chah would give a talk, he'd go on for hours. And his talks mostly were very, very boring. Those of you who have listened or read his books, sometimes when I read those books, I can't recognize that that was my teacher. Because when you read some of those books of his talks, all the boring stuff has been edited out. Maybe 3 or 4 hours of boring stuff, and you've just got the pearls, the nice stuff. I had to wait for hours to hear just a little bit of that. So it's actually his talks are very, very boring. Now one night he was giving one of these endlessly boring talks. And when he's teaching, you can't even get up to go to the toilet. You have to sit there. Even though your legs are hurting, your back is aching, you've got to sit there. Now it's maybe okay for a monk because we're training ourselves, but sometimes you get these little novices, 11, 12 years of age, they're put into the monastery because there's nowhere else they can go. And this poor little novice, I think about 12 years of age, was getting very, very upset. He said, I'm only a small boy, I need my sleep. 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, I'm tired, I'm aching. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is the teacher going to stop? And that's how he was moaning and complaining to himself for over an hour. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? And at one moment, this little novice gained a deep insight into the Dhamma. A very easy insight. Instead of saying, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? He thought, when am I going to stop? And the little novice stopped. When he opened his eyes later, Ajahn Chah and all the monks had long gone from the hall. He'd been sitting in blissful meditation. He'd let go, he'd stopped, all his pain and aches had completely disappeared. He'd put all his mindfulness into knowing rather than into complaining, into changing, into trying to go somewhere where the pain wasn't. He went into it. He went against the stream of going into the pain, into the complaint, rather than being pushed away. I say this going against the stream can be compared to being chased by a ghost. Imagine a fearsome, dangerous ghost is chasing you. You'd run for your life. That's going with the stream. Imagine stopping, turning around, and going boo to the ghost. Then the ghost gets scared. That's called going against the stream. You say boo to the pain. You don't run away. You stop. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Everyone would be living in small little huts like the monks. Imagine the amount of housework that would save you. Imagine the amount of taxes that would save you. Imagine the amount of environmental damage that will save you. Now, of course, the point is that everyone would never be content. The contentment is for the elite, you. Now, your question is like the same question. What if everyone became a monk or a nun? And the point is, there was an old story in the suttas. There was an earthworm who was eating the earth, because that's what earthworms eat. And this earthworm started to think, what if all the earthworms eat the earth? Actually, there's many earthworms already. They're soon going to eat all the earth. There'll be nothing left for me to eat. And the earthworm was very afraid. because he thought the earth would soon be eaten up. Just like the person who thinks if everyone becomes a monk or a nun, soon there'll be nobody left. Or if we practice contentment, there'll be nobody doing things anymore. The point is there'll always be people who are discontent. There'll always be people who are not being monks. You don't need to worry about that one. So the point is here that we can practice contentment if we want to end suffering. There's another little story that when I was a young monk, I saw all of the senior monks getting all the best food. They get the food and they pass it down the line. Monks like Ajahn Chah would get first choice. When it came to me, you'd only get the gravy if you were lucky. And I thought, this is really unfair. Because all those senior monks, not only were they fat already, but also they were all probably enlightened. They didn't really need to worry about tastes and food. Little monks like me, that we weren't enlightened, we're the ones who needed the delicious food. Because delicious food is wasted on enlightened people, isn't it? So I thought that all the food should start from the young monks and little novices, because we really needed the delicious food. Not only that, but all the soft big cushions, they were all given to the senior monks. Have you ever seen all the big cushions go to the abbots? And all the junior monks, especially the little novices, have to sit on the hard floor. At that time I was just so thin and bony. I was the one who needed the cushions, not those fat monks at the top. They had their own upholstery. And then when I started to complain about this, one of the monks said, "Now listen, you've experienced something called junior monk suffering. When you get to be a senior monk, you'll get the soft cushions, you'll get the choice of the food, but you'll get senior monk sufferings. Why do I have to teach a retreat in Penang again? Why do they keep coming up to me asking the problems about their marriage? Why do I always have to be told the problems?" That's called senior monk suffering. It's just like in life. When you're single, you've got single person suffering. And you want to get married. And it's true, once you get married, you get rid of single person suffering. You don't have single person suffering anymore, you have married person suffering. And when you're married, you think, "I want children because I've got, you know, just no children suffering." When you get married, you don't have no children suffering anymore, you have children suffering. When you're working, you think of retiring. Because you don't have, when you're working, you've got work suffering, having to get up every Monday morning. Have you seen people who get retired? Once they retire, they get retired suffering. They get bored. So often in life, all of our cravings, all of our wanting, is actually getting rid of the suffering we have now, only to get other suffering afterwards. Many of you yogis were working last week. You couldn't wait to get on this retreat. Last week you had work suffering. Now you have meditation retreat suffering. So when are we going to end all this suffering business? Not by changing one form of suffering to another. Some women want to make good karma so they can be reborn as men. True, you get rid of women's suffering, but then you get men's suffering. Some men want to be women. They get rid of men's suffering, they become women's suffering. Some of my stupid disciples in Perth want to get reborn as cats. You know why? Because cats don't have to go to work. They get fed two or three times a day, and they sleep in nice places without having any responsibilities at all. Because they think, "Oh, I get reborn as a cat," especially in the West. Imagine, you don't have to do any work at all. You don't have to go to school. You don't have to get any degrees. You just have to sit there and be stroked. That's all the work you have to do in your whole life. Just sit there and be stroked and meow every now and again to get fed. What an easy life, they say. So the point is that sure that when you leave the human realm, you don't have human person suffering, like having to go to school and having to go to work, but then you get cat suffering. Cats have much suffering. So a lot of times, all our aspirations are just really trying to get rid of one suffering to get another suffering. You never get rid of suffering that way. It's the story of the dog with the mange. A dog with a mange. This is a story, one of Ajahn Chah's favorites, which actually came from the Buddha. A dog with this terrible itch on its body was standing out in the sun, thinking if it's out in the sun, the itch will go away. It never went away, so it tried to escape. It ran into the shade of the forest. It was itchy as ever. So it ran into the village. It was still itchy. It ran into the water. It was still itchy. It ran under a rock. It was still itchy. Wherever it ran, the itch went with it, because the itch was on its body. It didn't depend upon the circumstances the dog was in. It depended upon the itch which it was carrying around with it. That itch, the Buddha said, is craving. Wherever you go, if you have craving, you will have the itch, suffering. So, running away, try to change things. You might try and change your partner. Get divorced and try again. When you've got the itch, you'll always get the scratch, suffering. So it doesn't change things. The thing is, we stop, we face up. We get contentment, we learn where we are. And that way we're at peace with being a junior monk and a junior monk suffering. We're at peace with being an abbot and having an abbot suffering. We're at peace with being a cancer patient and having cancer suffering. Then we're free. Whatever happens to you in life, you're not suffering anymore, because you're content to be there. What would happen if everyone did this? Then everybody would be enlightened. What do you think of that? Any questions? Yeah, go on. Okay, you're asking the question about if you eat fish, you are increasing the demand for fish. If you increase the demand for fish, aren't you encouraging more fishermen to go out and kill those fish? So in other words, eating fish, is that helping to kill fish? I know that when I was in Thailand, I used to ask the Thai fishermen this, and they told me they never kill fish. Thai fishermen never kill fish, they said. They only take the fish out of the water and the fish die themselves. Now you see, when you really want to do something, you can always find a way in the means of explaining it to yourself. Now the point is that it is encouraging the destruction of life, but then again, so is eating rice. Do you eat rice? Isn't that encouraging the farmers to plough the field? When they plough the field, doesn't that kill so many little worms, beetles, insects? And what it doesn't actually kill with the plough, doesn't it unearth those animals and insects so the birds can go and eat them? It does. I lived many years in the countryside of northeast Thailand. Every time you'd see the farmers ploughing the fields, and always be birds following the plough. Even eating rice encourages the destruction of life. The point is that whatever you eat in life, whatever you do, if you drive here to listen to a Dharma talk, sometimes as many insects get killed under the tires of your car or on the windscreen. Whatever we do, we destroy life. The point of practice is try to lessen that as much as possible. We can't eliminate it completely, but we can lessen it. So however much you can lessen the destruction of life, the better, out of compassion. If you can eat less fish, fine. If you can destroy less animals, even like having smaller houses so you don't dig the earth so much, whatever it is, see how we can lessen destruction of life. And that is called compassion. But you can never eliminate it. Some people need to eat fish for one reason or another, so don't blame them. When I was a vegetarian, before I became a monk, I was a fundamentalist vegetarian. I was staying in my mother's house. After she cooked her meat, I would scrub the frying pan 3 or 4 times to disinfect it from the meat before I'd cook my veggies. Once I went to dinner with my girlfriend. She cooked a dinner for me. I don't know why, but she forgot that I was a vegetarian and she cooked some meat, a curry with some rice. I refused to eat it. I felt so sorry about that afterwards, because I realized I loved animals, but I hated people. My compassion should have gone to her as well. She made a mistake. She cooked the food already. I should have eaten it out of kindness to her. She went to such a lot of trouble cooking a meal for me. And all I did was say no and upset her. So remember, be kind to animals, but also be kind to those who eat meat as well. Make sense? So your karma is your karma. If you can give up eating fish, great. If you can be kinder, great. But don't go around criticizing others. That's not being kind to them. Any other questions? Okay, we'll make it an early night. So you want to make some announcements? The next talk, remember, is Why Me? That's the law of karma. Today I was talking about the law of contentment, about not doing things. Tomorrow is about doing things.